chaos in Gaza's southern city of Rafah as fears of Israel's promised incursion leads to a mass exodus.
A massive ground attack in Rafah would lead to an epic humanitarian disaster and pull the plug on our efforts to support people as famine looms.
Deep divisions have escalated since the Hamas attack on October 7th and Israel's response in Gaza, but there are signs of goodwill.
I don't think there's anything political about feeding starving people. And it turns out that many, many American Jews and plenty of other people think that too.
And an Israeli singer faces cheers and boos as she makes it to this weekend's grand final in the Eurovision Song Contest. Today is Saturday, May 11th. Join us as we explore the issues in the news. Hi, everyone. I'm Lori London in Washington. Israeli forces bombarded areas of Rafah this week as Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu dismissed U.S. President Joe Biden's threat to withhold weapons from Israel if it assaults the southern Gaza city. Netanyahu vowed to press ahead with a planned widespread operation, saying, if we have to stand alone, we will stand alone. Meanwhile, White House National Security spokesperson John Kirby said Friday, the U.S. believes there are better ways to go after what is left of Hamas in Gaza than a major ground operation in the terror group's densely populated last stronghold of Rafah.
Any kind of major Rafah ground operation would actually strengthen Hamas's hands at the negotiating table, not Israel's. That's our view.
And ahead of Israel's promised operation to target Hamas in the southern Gaza city of Rafah, the UN says more than 100,000 people have fled the city.
The situation in Rafah is on a knife's edge as airstrikes continue throughout southern Gaza. Over 1 million Palestinians, half of whom are children, have crowded in the Rafah governorate for shelter.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, at a news conference in Nairobi Friday, said at a time when fragile humanitarian operations urgently require expansion, the Rafah military operation is further limiting the ability to reach thousands of people living in dire conditions without adequate food, sanitation, health services, and security.
Humanitarian partners have no tents or food stores left in South Gaza.
The city on the border with Egypt is also a crucial hub for bringing in food, medicine, fuel, and other goods. Joining us now is Kieran Donnelly, Senior Vice President for Crisis Response, Recovery, and Development with the International Rescue Committee, who says even the limited operation Israel launched earlier this week has thrown humanitarian operations into crisis.
The situation on the ground in Rafah today is characterized by chaos, fear, and a huge amount of humanitarian need. Rafah has become hugely overcrowded, 1.3 million people sheltering there, having fled, some of them displaced multiple times from other parts of Gaza. It is acutely short of all of the essential supplies that people need for life. And while there's a little bit more aid getting into Rafah because of its proximity to the border with Egypt than there is into northern Gaza, where we're seeing the worst famine-like conditions, conditions in Rafah are hugely difficult for people who are trying to survive there. With the announcement of the evacuation orders from Israel and the commencement of an accelerated level of shelling and bombing in Rafah over the last few days, what we've seen is real panic start to set in. People are fleeing, trying to make a decision whether or not to flee. Can they afford to flee? Where will they go? There's nowhere safe in Gaza for people to go. The areas that have been designated for people to relocate to are not in themselves safe and have even less access to services and to aid than Rafah does. So it's an incredibly worrying situation on the ground. And if Israel does proceed with a full-on assault on Rafah, we're going to see a humanitarian catastrophe even worse than what we've experienced over the last number of months.
My understanding is that the last working hospital is now not working in Rafah.
I've seen reports, yes, that the hospital has been closed down in order to evacuate. We haven't been able to verify that directly ourselves. But this comes, obviously, in the wake of the complete degradation of the health system across Gaza as a whole, where almost all of the hospitals in Gaza are not functioning. Only a very few remain functioning and are a fraction of their pre-crisis levels. The primary healthcare system has collapsed, and this comes in a context in which the numbers of people seeking healthcare, in need of healthcare, has grown exponentially as a result, not just of bombing and fighting, but also of overcrowding, lack of access to food supplies, lack of access to safe water, the unsanitary conditions in which they live. My colleagues are reporting rivers of sewage flowing down streets with children playing in them. And in a context like that, with this continued degradation of the healthcare system and the latest reports of the closure of the last hospital in Rafah, its public health catastrophe is on the brink of exploding.
We're hearing there also have been crossing closures threatening what little aid was coming in, and that potentially no trucks since Sunday. What are you seeing as far as any aid getting in at all?
So the reports I've seen are that the Rafah border crossing remains closed, that no trucks have crossed, as you say, since Sunday. I've seen reports that Kerem Shalom border crossing has been open, but I have not seen any reports confirming that aid has crossed through that border. Rafah is not just where 1.3 million people have sought shelter. It's also ground zero for the aid effort in Gaza, such as it is. And we know that due to the limitations on border crossings and the dangerous conditions on the ground, not enough aid has been getting in, nowhere close to enough aid. But the aid that is getting in depends on access to Rafah, depends on those border crossings, depends on aid agencies like the International Rescue Committee and our partners being able to access our facilities in Rafah in order to be able to serve people across Gaza. So with the border crossing being closed, every day that stays closed and that trucks aren't able to get in and the humanitarian personnel are limited in their ability to provide support, the crisis deepens even further.
And as you said, people aren't even sure where they can go to be safe, but they were told to evacuate, that an operation was imminent. What is your team on the ground saying about their own safety and their ability to even give any support at this point?
Well, right now, although the bombing and shelling in Rafah has increased, humanitarian personnel are still able to move around, do still have some operational space right now, but we're preparing for the eventuality of an all-out assault. And what that will mean for us is needing to put teams into hibernation, relocate them to other parts of Gaza for their own safety, potentially relocating some back into Egypt. Our commitment is to stay and deliver for the people of Gaza for as long as we can, but obviously we can only do that if our own staff are safe. The area that the civilian population has been ordered to relocate to, or part of the civilian population has been ordered to relocate to, includes the Al-Mawasi zone, which has been cited as a safe zone. It is far from safe. It's littered with unexploded ordnance. It was in that same area that an IRC facility was struck by an Israeli warplane in January, an attack that we've documented and reported on. So for whether you're an aid worker or a civilian trapped in Rafah, there is no safe place in Gaza today.
What about the new pier that we hear has just been finished that the U.S. military was working on? Will that make a significant difference in getting aid in?
It will make a modest difference in getting aid in. Given the situation on the ground, any aid that can be provided is a welcome addition to the overall response effort. However, we have to be absolutely clear that the pier does not have the ability to deliver the aid that's needed at the volumes that it's needed, that it is considerably more expensive than the land route option. And there is no guarantee, no clarity yet as to whether the aid that's provided through the pier will have any kind of lighter check process, assessment process, than the aid that goes through the border crossing. So right now, there's a very arbitrary, intrusive, bureaucratic process that's delaying significantly the aid that can get through and limiting the aid that can get through the border crossings. And as far as we know, that's going to apply equally to aid coming through this floating pier arrangement. And so whether it's airstrikes, piers, anything that can be done to provide aid is good, but we shouldn't allow ourselves to be deluded into thinking that that's a substitute for the what's really needed, which is opening border crossings, reducing the checks at border crossings, and a ceasefire, an end to the fighting, to create the conditions on the ground inside Gaza in which aid agencies can operate and in which people can move to receive aid.
Absent that, if Israel follows through with what it says it plans to do in Rafah,
it feels Israel follows through on its plans and in the absence of a ceasefire agreement, we're going to see further mass displacement. We're going to see large numbers of people inevitably killed and injured. And we are going to see an acceleration of both the public health threats, the disease vectors that are already rampant inside Gaza, and the food insecurity situation. The famine that is creeping its way southwards from northern Gaza will only accelerate.
In your experience as a humanitarian worker, as well as many of your colleagues, how does this war, this situation in Gaza, compare to what you've seen in any previous conflict?
In over 20 years working in this sector, I can't recall a situation in which we've seen as many people driven into such deep suffering as quickly as we have seen in Gaza. Nor have I seen a situation in which the solutions to bring about a halt to the fighting, the end to suffering, are so clear, and yet the world stands by and watches. And as the prospect of an assault on Rafah looms, it's clearer than ever what needs to happen to protect people inside Gaza. But it's far from clear that the world, and including Israel's partners in the U.S. and elsewhere, are going to take the actions needed to protect those people.
Thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us about this important issue.
Of course. Thanks for your interest, Laurie.
Kieran Donnelly, Senior Vice President for Crisis Response, Recovery and Development with the International Rescue Committee. The UN says most of the territory's 2.3 million Palestinians are suffering from hunger, and northern Gaza is already experiencing full-blown famine. The first shipment of humanitarian aid bound for a U.S.-built pier in Gaza left a port in Cyprus on Thursday. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb reports the aid is desperately needed as the Rafah border crossing, as we just heard, remains closed by Israeli forces.
Crate after crate of food and water bound for Gaza are loaded Thursday on the Sagamore container ship to be transferred to another U.S. ship, the MV Roy Benavidez. The U.S. military now pre-positioning aid at sea while waiting to move a newly completed U.S.-made floating pier into position off the Gaza coast. Pentagon Press Secretary Major General Pat Ryder.
Since the Benavidez will be on the scene, so to speak, the day we pull the trigger and start operations, that then frees up the Sagamore to go back to Cyprus to load up with additional aid. But because we're, again, waiting for the appropriate security and weather conditions to kick this off, we're going to use that time to our advantage.
The situation in Gaza grows more urgent by the day, with life-sustaining aid running low. Michael O'Hanlon is with the Brookings Institution.
The 2 million Palestinians who live in Gaza are collectively near famine. This is, as I understand the numbers, one of the most dire food situations really in recent history.
Officials say the U.S.-built pier will bring in dozens of truckloads of aid per day, at a time when defense analyst Michael O'Hanlon says airdrops from the U.S. and others, along with truck traffic at border crossings, has been drastically inadequate.
This pier is desperately needed and actually overdue. And the numbers I've seen imply that it could actually help deliver a substantial fraction of what's needed.
Officials say security measures are in place to protect U.S. troops on the pier and civilians distributing aid on the beach. Again, Pat Ryder.
We would certainly hope that if Hamas truly does care about the Palestinian people, that they would not threaten humanitarian assistance being delivered to people in dire need. And for our part, we'll continue to work with the international community to rush that aid in.
Officials say aid distribution via sea could begin as soon as next week. Carla Babb, VOA News, The Pentagon.
The United Nations General Assembly has backed a Palestinian bid to become a full UN member. We hear more from Reuters correspondent Freddie Joyner.
In favor, 143. Against, 9. Abstentions, 25.
Recommending the UN Security Council reconsider the matter favorably. The vote serves as a global survey of support after the United States vetoed the idea in the UN Security Council a month prior. The Palestinian push for full UN membership comes 7 months into a war between Israel and Palestinian militants Hamas in the Gaza Strip, and as Israel is expanding settlements in the occupied West Bank, which the UN considers to be illegal.
We want peace. We want freedom.
Palestinian UN Ambassador Riyad Mansour spoke to the assembly before the vote.
A yes vote is a vote for Palestinian existence. It is not against any state. It is an investment in peace and thus empowers the forces of peace.
Meanwhile, Israel's ambassador to the United Nations, Gilad Erdan, who spoke after Mansour, accused the assembly of shredding the UN Charter.
You are shredding the UN Charter with your own hands. Yes, yes, that's what you're doing, shredding the UN Charter. Shame on you.
The vote by the General Assembly Friday does not give the Palestinians full UN membership, but simply recognizes them as qualified to join. An application to become a full UN member first needs to be approved by the 15-member Security Council, and then the General Assembly. If the measure is again voted on by the Council, it is likely to face the same fate, a U.S. veto.
That was Reuters correspondent Freddie Joyner. Expanding on the U.S. no vote, Deputy U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., Robert Wood.
Our vote does not reflect opposition to Palestinian statehood. We have been very clear that we support it and seek to advance it meaningfully. Instead, it is an acknowledgement that statehood will come only from a process that involves direct negotiations between the parties.
The October 7th Hamas attack and Israel's response in Gaza have led to deep divisions, a sharp rise in anti-Semitic incidents, and massive pro-Palestinian demonstrations spreading across college campuses in the U.S. and abroad. But there are still signs of goodwill. I spoke with Daniel Sokatch, chief executive officer of the New Israel Fund, who said the organization's Jewish donors have raised an unprecedented amount of money to feed people in Gaza.
Since the beginning of this war, NIF has felt that we need to respond beyond our normal kind of giving and support in Israel, which is usually is to civil rights and social change and pro-democracy organizations. The need was so horrific and horrendous and great in responding to 10/7 that people in the kibbutzim, the Bedouins in the villages, folks in towns near the Gaza border were devastated. And for too long, the government was unable to respond to their needs. And so Israeli civil society, including NIF, switched gears from the democracy protests to tend to people's basic needs. And we raised and sent millions and millions of dollars to help people who were hurt, the families of the hostages, people whose homes were destroyed. And we were very proud to do that. Fast forward to now, and that nightmare, it is metastasized because of the war that followed 10/7 into a humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza. And without even looking at the question of how that happened or why that happened or who's to blame, we saw tens of thousands of people being killed and hundreds of thousands homeless, millions homeless, and many people facing famine, what international aid organizations were warning about, famine. And so we knew immediately that since our moral north is helping all of the innocent people in the region in trying to pave the way for a better future for Israelis and Palestinians, it was sort of self-evident to us that we had to do our part to contend with the catastrophe unfolding. And so we contacted a number of aid organizations and ultimately decided to send support to the International Rescue Committee and World Central Kitchen. And both of those organizations were wonderful to work with, welcomed the support. And so we put the call out right before Passover. And over the course of the last month, thousands and thousands of people gave around $750,000 from around the world, which is going to those two organizations, which are trying to provide humanitarian relief and food for Gaza.
The situation has divided a lot of folks, and you all have pretty much stood by this expression of what you believe are the values of the vast majority of American Jews.
Yeah, NIF definitely has never worried about doing the popular thing in a given political moment. We try to do the right thing in alignment with our values. And I don't think there's anything political about feeding starving people. And it turns out that many, many American Jews and plenty of other people think that too.
This is an enormous amount of money. Is this the first time that the organization has actually raised money to fund programs outside of Israel?
Yeah, it's the first time in my tenure here and the first time that I know of where any anything like this has happened.
This is a little different than a lot of the reports we've heard, that a Jewish organization is working so hard and raising this much money, directing it at Palestinians.
After 10/7, as I said, we raised and sent millions of dollars to suffering Israelis who were Bedouin, Arab citizens of Israel, Jewish citizens of Israel. It didn't matter to us. People were suffering after the horrific terror attacks, and we just responded because that's what we had to do. And similarly, now, as a result of a war that followed on after 10/7, and again, let's leave aside who's responsible or what happened, there are millions of people facing horrific conditions, including famine. And it was obvious that to us that we also had to respond. And NIF in the States is, of course, mostly a Jewish organization, insofar as we're mostly supported by progressive American Jews who share our vision and values for Israel. But within Israel, our staff is Jewish and Palestinian. Citizens of Israel, our grantees are Jewish and Palestinian Israeli grantees. The Israelis on our board contain both Palestinian citizens and Jewish citizens of Israel. So we feel like a mixed shared organization there in a different way. And every single Arab member of the board or the staff or the grantee community of NIF was 100% on board with trying to provide aid for suffering Israelis, regardless of what their religion or ethnicity or race was. And similarly, 100%, every single Jewish and Arab staff and board member supported this idea of getting aid into Gaza. It's a human thing. I think at core, we don't believe that this conflict is a conflict between Arabs and Jews or Israelis and Palestinians. It's a conflict between those who believe that violence is a legitimate means of achieving their political ends and those of us who believe that protecting human life is always going to trump that. And that's the side that we're on.
Daniel Sokatch, Chief Executive Officer of the New Israel Fund. Thank you so much for being with us. You're listening to Issues in the News. I'm Lori London. Roughly 100,000 visitors from 89 countries have descended this week on Malmö, Sweden, where the Eurovision Song Contest's final showdown culminates Saturday. Israel's Eden Golan made it through the semifinals this week and will be competing against acts from 25 other countries. Ilan Rubens with Reuters has more.
I'm coming here to show my voice, to share my love, my gift from God, and to hopefully make people feel something and leave a mark in their souls, and to unite by music.
20-year-old Eden Golan is representing Israel in the Eurovision Song Contest this week in Malmö, Sweden. The world's biggest song contest takes place as protests occur in many countries against Israel's military campaign in Gaza, which was triggered by Hamas's attack on Israel on October 7th. Hours and hours and Golan is competing with the song titled Hurricane, which initially went under the name October Rain. Israel tweaked the song after Eurovision organizers took issue with the lyrics from the original submission, which appeared to reference the October 7th attack.
So Hurricane, it's a very strong emotional power ballad that starts pretty quiet and it grows throughout the song. And it's a song about a girl or any person, any human being that is going through something within themselves, a hurricane of emotions, feelings.
The European Broadcasting Union's decision not to exclude Israel from this year's contest over the war has been met with protests. Host city Malmö is bracing for possible unrest, although police say there have been no concrete threats against the event. Golan says she's not worried about the potential protests.
I have the best security team to take care of me and the entire delegation, and it's up to the people what to do. They have the right to speak their voice, but I'm focusing on my part, which is giving the best performance and on the good vibes, the good people.
That was Ilan Rubens with Reuters reporting. Israel has won Eurovision's contest four times in the past. And that's all the time we have for this week. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you very much for listening. For more news throughout the week, listen to International Edition Monday through Friday or visit us anytime at voanews.com. Join us next week for more Issues in the News. Until then, I'm Lori London.